You have spent hours mapping out the third floor with no sign of an exit. As you are walking down a narrow, dark corridor, a stealthy goblin lunges at you from the shadows. Startled, you leap back. As his blade nears your skin, you duck and roll to the right. You stumble into the blackness of an unseen passageway. Wanting only to escape the bloodthirsty goblin, you run blindly forward until you see a light. Before you lies a strong door of an elvish design. In the ancient elvish script, it is written,
Famicom Disk System. A note, this episode was recorded live, gathered around a real Famicom and a real CRT television. The sound quality may suffer a bit, but I hope you will enjoy it anyway.
Today on Doors and Dungeons, we have a special episode for you. If you recognize that sound, that was the Famicom Disk System. And here to talk more about the Famicom Disk System, it's me, Michelle, of course, and
I'm Rowan. I'm one of the hosts of Platforms and Pitfalls, a game design podcast, and don't know anything about the Famicom Disk System, really.
Which is, by the way, where we talked about the Famicom Disk System recently, so you can find out more about that by going to that show and checking out part one of this discussion.
And I'm Tom, host of the podcast Wyverns and Winnebagos, which doesn't exist. Hi.
I want to hear that. Wyverns and Winnebagos. I need to find out about this. Okay, so last time on the Platforms and Pitfalls podcast, we talked about several games for the Famicom Disk System that were released in America and how they were different.
And a few that weren't. Neurosame Joe was one of the ones that wasn't released in the US.
Right. And so we mainly covered popular Nintendo first-party titles. So, well, Castlevania's not first-party, but it was very popular mainstream game. We talked about Zelda. We talked about,
Doki Doki Panic, Kid Icarus, and Murasame Joe.
Yes. And we talked a little bit about how they were all different from the American releases, with the exception of Murasame Joe, which wasn't released in America, but it kind of ties in with the others, especially Zelda, because it uses the same engine as The Legend of Zelda, but in a completely different way. And so we wanted to contrast that with what we in America know and the West know as Zelda, and what Japan has as Murasame Joe, which is a very different idea of that.
Yeah, very arcadey perspective on what the Zelda engine could get at.
Very Konami, I would say. And so today what we're going to do is we're going to go further into the Famicom Disk System, and we're going to play some games that you've probably maybe never heard of. If you are really interested in this stuff, you might know these games, but you may not have ever played them. And we're going to talk about them. But first, just before we get started, I want to talk a little bit about more just what the Famicom Disk System hardware is. We briefly mentioned it in the Platforms and Pitfalls. So the Famicom Disk System came out about 1 or 2 years later after the Famicom came out.
I think 1986.
The original Famicom came out in 83, so that's about 3 years later. It's hard to believe the original Famicom came out in 83 in Japan.
Because I don't think I even knew that.
Yeah, it's very, very early. Mm. Of course, West, we got it several years later. But the Famicom Disk System is a floppy disk drive that is bigger than the Famicom itself. Roughly. Actually, if you take the Famicom and put it on top of the Famicom Disk System, it's really cute. It's a cute little combo. Yeah. I have the later model, which doesn't look as cute with it. But if you put the original one together, and it was designed that way, it was designed to look cute like that.
And even, like, it's so cute, for the Japanese release of the Famicom Mini, there were lots of accessories or a carry case you'd put under it so that looked like the Famicom disc system. Like, it holds a big nostalgic part in the local culture here.
In fact, in Akihabara, one time I found a device which I believe was first party Nintendo, which is basically a plastic shell that connects the two, and you could set your Famicom on top of the disc system, and this little shell would like hook in to lock them together, which is really cute, and I wish I'd bought it, but I hadn't. Anyway, so you've got this base disc system, and then you've got this device that runs a cable from that disc drive to a cartridge that sits flat in the system, not like vertically the way a normal cartridge would. And I'm sorry, I got this wrong on Rowan's podcast. I called it the ROM cartridge. It's actually called the RAM cartridge. My apologies. And it adds a little bit of extra RAM, mostly for the disk controller. It also adds the disk controller, the BIOS for that. And it also adds an extra sound chip, which gives you some wavetable synthesis. I think it's 3 channels of wavetable synthesis. And as we talked about in the podcast, it's somewhat effective.
Yeah, there's a very different quality to the music that comes out. Not good or worse, just like it sounds like it's from a different machine, which it is.
I think a lot of people have probably heard Castlevania 3, the original version versus the American version.
Yeah.
And that's the reason for that. And Castlevania 3's original version sounds considerably different, I'd say.
Yeah. But now, in that case, you know, Konami used a special chip inside their cartridge that added that sound. So I think that sound actually meshes quite better.
Oh, was that not the disc system?
No, Castlevania 3 is not disc system.
My apologies there. Yeah, I see. I'm on this podcast with these people, but I know nothing about the disc system. I basically am like touching it practically for the first time today. So
I see. Well, that's good because we're going to get your impressions here soon. But actually, Castlevania 1 and 2 are on the disc system. 3 was cartridge.
Okay,
and it's a good that you mentioned that, actually, because it's kind of highlights the main reason why we never got the disc system in America, which is that by the time the disc system was about ready to come out in America, the cost of the components in the cartridge was low enough that it was not cost effective to release games on the floppy discs anymore, which the Famicom disc system is a floppy disc drive unit. I didn't mention that. It became cheaper. At first, it was cheaper to make a cartridge game, but you were very limited in how much data you could put on one of those chips. And if you wanted to put more in there, you needed to include more chips, and the chips were kind of expensive. So the more you put on a game, the more that game cost. With the Famicom disk system, you suddenly had a whole floppy disk worth of space, which it wasn't a big amount of space, but it was definitely bigger.
Yeah, I think the discs are only, 300-something kilobytes total for both sides? Or is it even less than that?
I think it might even be less than that.
Yeah.
I think it might be somewhere around, 128. I checked this out.
That's about what you told me.
I think it was, 125.
Or something like that, yeah. The files end up being a little bigger for headers and things.
Right.
Yeah, and I don't know a whole lot about it, so I'm sorry to interject, but I do know that these are completely proprietary floppy disks. They're not normal floppy disks.
They're actually not, I wouldn't call them proprietary. They're actually made by a company called Mitsumi. They're actually called a Mitsumi Quick Disk, I believe is what they were called. And Nintendo made a deal with them in order to make sure that you couldn't just throw your own Mitsumi Quick Disk in there. They actually have a tiny bit of protection. So it's the simplest protection in the world. If you look at a Famicom disk system game, it says Nintendo on the top. And it doesn't just say it, it's actually like stamped into the plastic. It's kind of notched in. And there's a little reverse shaped Nintendo plate inside the drive. And when the disk goes in, it falls down and those grooves for the Nintendo name fits into the Nintendo nameplate on the inside of the disk drive. And it provides a physical barrier, so if you don't have that, it won't go all the way down.
I think that's so cool. It's, so simple. It gives the discs a very distinctive look, because they're bright yellow. They're all bright yellow, aren't they?
There's a few that are blue that are released later, but
but they're not, the standard, what you think of a generic blue floppy disk. They're not that. Right. They're a little bit different, which I think is cool.
It does look cool, but it's also really, really easy to circumvent that, unfortunately. And later on, Nintendo added an extra chip in later models of that so that you couldn't just rewrite discs. And it tried to lock out the writing protection or ability on that drive, but then later that was eventually hacked as well. So this hardware is really cool. It plugs into this RAM adapter. The RAM adapter does all the really, you know, the hard work. And it loads the game data and all that kind of stuff. And so you get saves data because you can write to the actual discs. And as I was saying, this technology was perfect when it came out, but it was quickly outpaced by the cartridge technology because it became drastically cheaper to produce those chips not long after. And by the time Castlevania 3 came out, it was cheaper for Konami to make it on a cartridge, and Konami in Japan anyway released it with a special mapper that they had designed, which is by the way, a mapper is a chip that gives you some graphics abilities, some memory mapping abilities, and sometimes even sound abilities. Konami had produced their own chip in-house with added functionality. And there's a handful of those chips that were designed by different companies that provide that. This one is called, I believe it's the VRC6?
Six, yeah.
I always get this wrong. It's VRC6?
Yeah, and just like for people who don't know what mappers do exactly, like a good example I think of one is that Mario Brothers 3 has a mapper that allows for horizontal and vertical scrolling, which most NES games couldn't do both at once. You had to pick one or the other for most things. And that's sort of abilities that they would enable alongside just more storage and more audio channels and things.
Mario 3 actually also allowed you to make smaller sprites, which is how they did. So Mario 3 is a weird, this is a total aside, I'm going to make it really brief. But Mario 3 actually does a weird thing where all of the normal size sprites are actually four sprites connected. So that's how when the bricks, like the blocks break into small blocks, those are the actual sizes of the sprites in the game. And they, using this mapper is custom designed to connect all these sprites and then throw them into the graphics memory, in the right, you know, layout. So it's kind of like extra processing to process like four sprites at once. So Mario is like four pieces. And the blocks are four pieces, and the enemies are like four pieces. And that's how they created like the little tiny stuff and the little tiny mini Goombas and the little blocks that break into multi pieces, which is something that was quite of a technical marvel at the time. But so the point is, regardless, the disk system became obsolete just a few years into its life cycle, which is kind of sad because it's a really cool concept. It's cheaper. The games were typically cheaper.
Yeah, the games were around 3,000 yen, which is about half price, I think, compared to a regular Famicom game.
Right. And then also, they could be rewritten, so you could take it to a store, and there was a kiosk there, and you could write a new game to it, which was really cool, and it was a lot cheaper to write a new game to it. I think you could write a game for like 600 yen, and then you could pay a few hundred yen more to get the instruction manual with it, if you wanted to. So you could buy a game, play it, decide you're done with it, and instead of buying a whole new game, you just rewrite it at the kiosk and get something new. This leads to the problem, which is that sometimes people didn't change the labels. So now, you know, 30 years later, you go to a store and you try and buy an old game and you take it home and you plop it in and it's the wrong game. But there is a workaround for that, which we will talk about in just a moment. Today, the Famicom disk system is a little bit difficult for a lot of people to use and play, and so there's a new device, well, it's a few years old now, called the FDS stick. And this is a USB device, and all you need in order to play Famicom disk systems on your original Famicom is, well, a Famicom, of course. Will not work with an American NES, sorry folks, that's what happens when you make a toaster VHS tape thing. I mean, not a toaster, a VHS tape thing, insert, blah, blah, blah. The cartridge doesn't fit, the RAM cartridge. But anyway, all you need is a Famicom, a RAM adapter cartridge thing, and that stick. And it just plugs into the cable where your Famicom disk drive unit would go. And that little stick has a button on the top, which allows you to press it once for side one, twice for side two, and so on, so you can flip the disks.
And that disc clipping is something that I think modern gamers might not even, like, understand as a thing. Like, I was kind of shocked, even as someone who dealt with the floppy disk era, of dual-sided floppies.
True. That's true. I think earlier gamers remember, like, some of the early, like, the Apple II and that kind of thing, the Commodores, I think, where they were double-sided, where you actually had to flip the disc yourself.
Yeah, I actually have never dealt with that. Every computer I've ever used that has double-sided floppy disks had never required flipping.
Interesting.
It was just an automatic process. But, I mean, the best way to envision it, I think, for most people would be like a cassette tape or something.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. But basically, in the old days, before floppy drives had double heads on them to read both sides of the disk at one time, they had to be flipped. And this one also, being a kind of low-end floppy drive device, also has to be flipped. And when I say low-end, it's super low-end. The reason why you don't see a lot of these Famicom drive units in America is because they're almost all broken. They have rubber bands inside them that drive the floppy drive so that when it spins, it's like a rubber belt, and those rubber belts just fall apart over time. So because of that kind of thing, people have come up with an alternative, which is the FDS stick. It's great for someone who's overseas because you don't have to go and find all the discs. You can download the ROMs. You don't have to find a working drive unit. You just get that RAM adapter, plug it in, and go. And so that's what we're going to be using for most of this podcast today, because it's just a little bit easier. But we're going to actually go in and talk about some of these games live with you, woohoo, sound and all. So get ready. And we're going to talk first about a game called I, Senshi, Nico. Does anyone have anything else they wanted to say about the Famicom disk system before we do that?
Nothing specifically about the disk system, but our setup, we are actually literally like circled or semi-circled around a microphone in front of a TV with the Famicom next to it. And so you will be hearing the actual audio coming from the TV speakers. And when we are flipping disk sides, you're going to hear the click on the FDS stick as well. So I guess enjoy this ASMR experience.
You're hearing an authentic experience, yes. Mostly.
So let's get this started. So let's load up I, Senshi, Nico, Tom.
All right. A button, go! Doesn't make any noise at first. So.
Ah, well.
So yeah, you both had mentioned with I, Senshi, Nico that it feels to you like a Konami game. As someone who didn't play Konami games of the NES era, why does this make you think Konami? Wait, the different game felt like Konami game.
Well, because this is a Konami game.
This is like Konami because it is a Konami game. Sorry. Okay. I'm thinking about a different game that you both mentioned felt like one.
That was Murasame Joe.
Sorry.
A Konami game. Yeah. And Murasame Joe, since it is a Famicom Disk System game, we'll mention it. It does feel like a Konami game because it feels very much like Goemon.
Ah, I see.
Yeah, I could see that. So, I, Senshi, Nico, it feels very Konami, yes.
This opening is really cute. There's like the future land Golden Gate Bridge. It's very, you know, like a vaporwave color scheme. And then, you know, our hero Nicole with his lovely cute girlfriend whose name I don't know, both have pink hair and blue jumpsuits, are standing on the side of the bridge when this alien brain thing shows up and throws her in a bubble and runs away. And then Nicole says,
"Oh, my God!"
in two different phrases. Oh! Exclamation point. My God.
No space.
No space.
Here's the click ASMR for you. I don't know if you could actually hear that. Probably not.
Probably not. But yeah, that was the changing the disc. And now, with Famicom disc games, in a lot of the cases, the opening title screen and the saved your data loading data is all on side A, and then side B is where the game data usually is. Mm-hmm. There are a few games where you actually have to flip the game while you're playing them, which is a little bit janky at times and frustrating, but there's not that many of those, fortunately.
And so usually this allows, like, you having a really pretty opening cinematic and a really pretty ending cinematic, I assume, as well?
It can be. It's not always the case. Some makers didn't bother. Some, like Konami here, did. So it really just depends. But it definitely can be that way. Oftentimes, it's the programming data for the actual saving system. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes you'll actually load the game on side B, and then you'll have it in there, and then when it comes time to save the game, you have to flip it back to side A to save your game, and then flip it back to B to continue.
Yeah, this game is really good, actually. I mean, I haven't gotten far in it. I just played it for the first time, like, not too long ago. But this is classic Konami NES quality in every way. I mean, it looks good. The music is good and moody. The gameplay, it kind of has a look to it that reminds me a bit of, like, Crystalis or something of that nature. Mm. And the gameplay is kind of similar as well. You can jump, you can shoot, but it's all about, like, exploring this enemy base and stuff. It's very good.
I have a copy of the actual game here, and I just took a moment there to go and get it, and I wanted to do that for a specific reason. There's a video that I have on YouTube, to give you a little bit of backstory before I say that, which is not how you're supposed to do a podcast, but oh well. So this game is one that a friend of mine bought on a whim on the Famicom Disk System. He was collecting stuff, and I sat down and I played it, and I was like, this game is great! And of course I asked him if he'd let me buy it, because I hadn't seen another copy, and he was like, no, I won't keep it. So I was like, okay. So I went and looked online, and for a while I couldn't find it. But then I found a copy with the instruction manual and the disc and everything, you know, in the case and so on Amazon, and I think it was 3,000 yen, so not super expensive. So I was like, okay, cool, it's got all the stuff, not expensive price, I'll buy it. I buy it. Tom just fell down a hole, by the way.
Yes, I did. That's what that noise is, which is a really cool sound effect, and I don't think that can be done on normal Famicom audio. That sounded very specific to Disk System editions.
Yeah, so that most likely is the wavetable synth from the Disk System.
And one of the notable things with this, so this is sort of a overhead exploration shooty sort of experience. I would associate falling into a hole would be take some damage, go back to a starting area. In this, though, it's a short little playable sequence with which you must escape the hole, which I think is just a little neat and pretty cool.
On some level, this game reminds me a bit of Star Tropics in terms of how it plays. Not the same theme at all, but in terms of like the actual control, it's similar.
I am about to die.
Especially late game, where you're running around in the alien spaceship, it feels a lot like that. But to go back to my story before Tom, hopefully... Oh, no, he got some extra life.
Yeah, I survived somehow.
But, so back to my story. I bought the game on Amazon, and it arrived unopened. There's a sticker on the back of... So let me explain here. Famicom Disk System games have a hard case, which is like a hard plastic disc case. And then it's got a sleeve inside that's got the game artwork, and a protector sleeve as well. And then outside of that, there is an instruction manual, and there's a little like warning label thing, and then in the case of Nicol, there's a little card that actually has a number on it, which is a character card, and it's actually numbered. It's a specific single numbered card. And then around that is a soft plastic case, and it's just a really thin soft case. You can open that up and get all your components out, your disc and your instruction manual, and so on. They have a Disk System sticker that goes on that case that's got the void label on it, and this one had never been voided. It had never been opened. So I'm like, oh, crap, what do? I want to play this game, but it's still original factory sealed. What am I going to do? So I thought about it for like a month, and I finally asked my friends and did some research online. I found that it's not a super expensive game, even unopened. So I just decided, okay, fine. I'm going to open this because I really want to play it. And I made a video of us opening it on YouTube. So if you want to see me opening that game with a couple of my friends in Akihabara, you can do that on my YouTube channel. But yeah, this is a game that needs to not just be collected. It needs to be played. It's really fun.
Yeah, this is extraordinarily polished, and as you would expect from classic era Konami, really. I mean, it feels every bit like their normal stuff.
And in the Platforms and Pitfalls episode, we used Murasame Joe as the sort of example that a lot of the FDS library is maybe not the most polished, and I think the later games we talk about maybe will be more emblematic even, of that, we take an idea, we try it, and maybe didn't put the time to succeed with it. But this is very contrary to that, and wouldn't be surprising as I think a full cartridge release.
Well, I think, yeah, and I actually kind of wonder why this didn't get a full cartridge release. This should have gotten a cartridge release by Konami, honestly. This could have been every bit as popular in America as all of Konami's other games were. And it's kind of odd to me that nobody knows about this game. I've never seen anyone talk about this game. I'm sure Jeremy Parrish has discussed it somewhere, because he discusses everything. But I've never seen it. I've never found, like, you know, people... Yeah, Tom keeps falling down holes. He's in a room where there's, like, a walkway. It's like an S-shaped walkway, and there's these little things you have to shoot to continue walking. It's, like, covered. And so he's got to shoot them all out of the way, and he's apparently messing it up.
You have to shoot diagonally, which involves specifically pointing yourself diagonally, and I keep walking as I shoot.
Yeah, that's Konami loves to do that in their games, use the diagonals. Contra is the same way. Contra, you have to do diagonals while walking, while shooting, and it can be very, very difficult. But, yeah. But this is a game that should have gotten an American release and would have done quite well and would have stood up as a classic. But you never, ever hear anyone talking about it. And that's why I decided that I think it really felt like it should be, like, the first mention. Now, some of the other games that we're going to talk about are definitely not as interesting or as polished as this. And he just got hit by an enemy and knocked off the platform again. So, overall, what would you say you'd rate this on a scale of A to F?
I guess for the Famicom Disk System context.
Yes.
Just that, not talking about other things, I'm going to put this in, like, the upper echelon. So let's say a B+.
Okay. Tom?
This is 100% my kind of game. This would be an A for me. Mm. Especially since, by the way, I am currently in possession of 83 Astro Pants.
This is true. You have Astroware, Cannon Shot, Power Shoes, Astro Pants, and Cosmo Ball.
And you don't have any diamonds.
Yeah, and right now I have 0 Astroware, 0 Cannon Shot, 2 Cosmo Balls, 2 Power Shoes, and 83 Astro Pants.
83
Astro Pants.
I need to pull out the instruction manual and find out what Astro Pants actually do. But go ahead and play this for a little bit while I do that, actually. Okay. That sounds like a good idea.
Sure.
Let's find out. Riveting podcasting material here. This is so hardcore, exactly how a podcast should be.
It's not that this is bad podcast. We are doing retro live radio. The kind of radio you do about a video game in the time of the Famicom Disk System. Because direct audio feeds would be quite difficult and such, I imagine, right?
This is true. We can
at least pretend that's the case, can't we?
This is true. Yeah, we'll do that.
Yeah.
Yokan to umi to kawa ni yotte ukeru damage ga sukunaku naru.
Oh, okay. So actually, it helps with, like, lava damage and stuff like that. That's cool.
Are you using them up every time you fall in?
Probably.
Ah.
You have a lot left over then. You've been in the lava a lot.
And I totally just died.
Cool. So let's move on to the next game.
Okay.
Which, go ahead and hit the turn off the Famicom and turn it back on.
3, 2, 1.
That's not necessary, but Tom likes to do it. So next we're going to play a game called All Night Nippon Super Mario Brothers. And, basically, this is Super Mario Brothers 1, but not.
Yeah, I actually took the liberty of finishing this in advance of the podcast, which is not easy, because this is, to my understanding, a mix of original Mario, Lost Levels, with some redone sprite work to make characters look like famous stars from the time, right?
Yeah, so this game was designed as a promotion for a radio show called All Night Nippon, and it was basically like a late-night radio show, and it had, I don't know if you call them DJs, but I guess they were DJs, essentially. And I don't know what the show was like, because I've never heard it, but I'm assuming it was kind of like a mix of like music and talk, which is what a lot of Japanese shows tend to be on the radio. As a radio fan, I actually listen to Japanese radio from time to time, and they tend to not do straight talk. If they do have a talk show, they always put music behind it, mm-hmm. but they tend to intersperse music in between like in American radio and probably other countries as well, there tends to be like 6 minutes of talk, and then they go to commercial break. They'll have what they call bumper music, which is just a song to lead out and lead in. But in Japanese, they tend to play music right in the middle. Just like they'll talk, and then they'll be like, oh, and here's a song, and then keep talking, and then here's a song. So they had these DJs and music and that kind of thing. And so this game was done as a promotion, and Nintendo released it. And basically, if I remember correctly, it was a contest. You had to like listen to the show and call in and try to win it. I don't remember if you had to actually, if you like, you sent in a card. Usually that's how it tends to be, is you send in a postcard. So maybe you have to be listening at a certain time, find the keyword or something, write it down on this postcard, and send it in. And if you were one of the lucky, I don't remember how many copies they released, but if you were one of the lucky people, you got All Night Nippon. And it is very much a remix of the original Super Mario Brothers, as
and Lost said. Levels. Yeah. That's right. And like for examples of some of the things that have changed, so a lot of the levels now look like they're at nighttime. The Koopas remain the same, more or less, but the Fire Flowers and Goombas are both replaced with faces from personalities.
I see. Yeah, so they are, radio personalities and so on.
And the princesses are all replaced with different personalities.
Well, yeah. Apparently it is the DJ Sunplaza Nakano and Tomori. Interesting. One of the things I really like is that they changed the first level to night. So several of the levels are actually changed to night.
All of them.
Are they all night?
I'm pretty sure they're all night.
Okay, because I thought I remember there being one that's not night.
I might be wrong. It happened once before.
Well,
I mean, it's all night Nippon, so they've got to all be night, or else it's a lie.
Well, they technically can't all be night, because some of them are underwater. And so the underwater levels...
water at night?
Well, they didn't do that much changes to this game. But this game was also published not technically by Nintendo. It was published by Fuji Television, who, as we mentioned, went on to do the publishing for Yume Kojo, Doki Doki Panic. Which was still kind of a joint thing with Nintendo, which just like this. However, Nintendo themselves didn't release it. Fuji Television did. And Fuji Television actually did a few other things, I believe, as well. Rare, but they did it. So, let's see. If I'm looking on Wikipedia here and find out exactly how many copies of this were made, I'm not 100% sure. Let's see. It doesn't say, but it was, of course, given away as a raffle. But it's a really cool thing because at first when you play it, it's like, okay, this is familiar. This is Mario Brothers 1. It's just nighttime. What the heck are these Goombas? And so on. But the further you get into it, the more it messes with you. And it's
that's
just
right.
Like, what is going on?
Like, oh, sorry.
Also, I think it's worth noting there are some other graphical changes, too. They actually changed the ground texture, and the texture for the mushrooms in 1-3 are now like trees. Mm. And just in general, there's just a lot of little graphical updates that honestly look pretty good. I think this ground texture is taken from Lost Levels, though, right?
Yeah, they did I'm not sure if it was from Lost Levels or not, but they did redo some of the sprite, some of the graphic tiles as well, yeah. Mm.
And so this game, for the first, like, four worlds or so, is mostly like Mario 1.
Yes.
And then the later half is, I'm assuming, more like Lost Levels. I have very little experience with Lost Levels itself, but there's a lot of, like, extremely difficult platforming challenges and even some horrible, like, Lost Woods-ish maze-like puzzles.
Ugh.
Also, I do know, I mean, this isn't a game I'm super familiar with. I've never played it, but I have watched a video about this game before, basically going into its history, and I've seen the ending as a result.
The
ending is completely changed.
Yeah, it is.
It shows basically kind of a circle of all the All Night Nippon characters around Mario.
Yes.
And stuff, yeah.
Those piranha plants are interesting. I don't know what those are. How did that happen? That should have counted as a hit, but oh yeah.
Me too. I would have thought so too, but it hates me.
I like the piranha plants are a dude, and he just pops up and he's laughing. He's just like, oh, when he pops up. Oh, that was a fun save you just pulled off there. slid off of a Goomba and almost missed the platform and still made some derp for the end. Yeah. So, oh, I see there's sunglasses. Mm-hmm. He's wearing sunglasses. The Piranha Plants are wearing sunglasses. It's a guy wearing sunglasses and he's laughing. But when you're in the underground stages, the colors are flipped, so it doesn't look like sunglasses. He just looks like a blue guy with giant orange eyes. But, yeah. The clouds are cute. But anyway, so this is a very interesting game, and it's worth trying out, because if you're a Mario fan, it's one of those, like, quirky little off things. And there were quite a number of things Nintendo did in the early game, in the early days, that were, you know, kind of one-offs or prizes or things like that. It was kind of a common thing, and a lot of them are very, very valuable now.
Which makes a lot of sense, because the discs were obviously cheaper to distribute than cartridges for a lot of the time. Hence them being about 3,000 yen versus 5,000 yen.
Well, also, there were a number of cartridge games that were given away as promotional prizes as well.
Mm.
Some of them, like I said, are also very nice save there. Some of them were also, again, very valuable now. For example, there's a game that's like completely worthless and not all that good, but I still love it anyway. It's a Gundam game called Zeta Gundam Hot Scramble. And it kind of plays like a mix of the Macross game and the, what's that called? What's that game that you really like that's, on MSX and some other stuff? And there was a sequel to it, Firehawk,
Texter,
yes.
Tigza?
Yeah. It plays very much like that. But it's a Gundam game. And they released it as a, like, prize, promotional prize that was, like, 100 copies made in a gold cartridge that were only for, like, winners of some, you know, Gundam magazine, such and such and such and such. And it costs, like, $900 a cartridge now. So that kind of stuff was definitely done. But yeah, this is neat. And so one thing I wanted to mention about the FDS stick, if you have an actual Famicom Disk System hardware, the drive, you can build a cable that goes between the stick and the drive, and you plug the stick into your USB port. There's a bit of software that's used to write the ROMs into the Famicom disk, the FDS stick. And this software is also called FDS stick. And you can use this software to read and write discs as well. So if you've got a save game on your disk and you want to back it up, you can write it into a file, and I mean read it into a file, and have your full disk. You can back up old disks as well, but you can also write disks. So if you buy a disk at the recycle store here in Japan and you get it home and it's the wrong game, you can go online, find the ROM, and overwrite it with the real game that it should be. Which also means that you can technically go out and buy a disk, take the label off, and put All Night Nippon and Super Mario Brothers on it, and then try and sell it. And I don't know if that will get you any money or not, but it might.
I would not recommend that.
I mean, who knows? So, that's a thing that possibly could be done. I don't know that I would do it, but I've always wondered what would happen if you did it. Because if you did it correctly, and it wrote properly and read properly, it might be a valuable disc to have. It might not. Or it might get you in trouble. But that's a fun little thing that you can do with the FDS stick. What I like to do with it, actually, is write translations to discs. So, for example, I think the Famicom disc version of Zelda 2 is a little bit better than the American release. So, someone has actually gone in and retranslated the Japanese version. And you can write that back to the actual floppy disk and put it in your drive and play it, which is cool. So that's some of the things that you can do. So, okay, this is Mario Brothers, but better, sort of. So, and nighttime. Oh, no, this is not a nighttime stage.
Sorry, yes,
oh,
you're
one.
Right.
It's not a nighttime stage.
We got an piece of evidence right at the end, just
it's
in time.
It's a lie. It's not all night Nippon.
It's
there's
mostly night
Nippon.
Nippon.
Some night Nippon.
Some night Nippon. Sam. No, San. San.
S-M-N. Summon. Summon.
Yeah. Anyway. We're going to move on to the next game.
No, S-N-N. What am I doing? Okay.
So, So the next game that we're playing is called Automana no Kiseki. I don't know if it's Almana or Automana or Armana, but yeah. And this is a Konami game. There's actually quite a few Konami games we're discussing today, which is kind of odd. This is a Konami game that feels, again, to me, a little bit more like an MSX game. Although, I would say that the style of platforming is a bit more NES-y, but the theme is more like what you'd see on MSX.
Yeah, well, there's actually a lot of people that I know of who've talked about this game before, because this one people actually have talked about. I've heard of this one many times, and there's a classic game called Rockin' Rope. I believe that's what it's called anyway. That basically has the exact same gameplay, but with single screen stages.
Okay. So what just happened there in the opening was there was some land which looked generically South American, and there was a stone-looking edifice on which there was a jewel. Was it a jewel, or what was that?
A stone statue? Tablet, it looks
stone
like.
Stone tablet, okay. And it was raining. And all of a sudden, it disappeared. The stone tablet thing disappeared. And these people walked up, and they were like, oh my god, the stone tablet disappeared. But they didn't actually say anything. They just kind of looked at it like, whoa. And then they turned to stone. And now you, Mr. Indiana Jones clone adventure man, are walking through an area where you... Oh. Can you duck? Yeah, okay, you can duck. Okay. So it's kind of a cavernously looking area, and there's all these little holes, which I keep thinking I should be able to walk into, like doors, but they're not. Enemies spawn out of them, apparently. And you can jump, you can shoot knives, but you've got a limited number of knives. Your main thing is you've got this, like, grappling hook, and it shoots diagonally up in whichever direction you're facing. And if it hits a platform or something, it can latch onto it, and it gives you a ropeway between where you're standing and where the platform is that allows you to climb up so that you can continue moving upwards, because you can't jump high enough to actually jump the ledges, most of them. So you need to use this grappling hook thing for your progression instead. So you're having to, like, grapple and all this kind of stuff, and some of it's kind of difficult because you got to, like, stand in the right place so you don't miss, and use that while also trying to not get killed by the enemies.
Yeah, I think it's worth noting, too, it's not just a grappling hook. It's like a grappling hook on a post that's exactly the same size as your body, and it doesn't shoot up at an exact diagonal. It's at, like, a weird kind of 35-degree angle. It's very odd proportions.
It's not like Bionic Commandos.
No.
Yeah, and it's also... you can also shoot it, like, while you're jumping, and if it happens to latch onto something, you'll just have this suspended post in the middle of the air that you're climbing off of. And it's very strange, but it is kind of fun to play around with.
So right now we're in an area where there's platforms, and we've got to jump, hit the ledge with our grappling hook while on a platform, and if we mess it up, we kind of fall down a lot. It's kind of annoying to do because the platform is moving, which means that you're not going to always instantly grab that grapple. And if you do, and the grapple doesn't connect in the right place, you're just going to fall down anyway.
And the way the moving platforms work, the vertical ones, it's often very easy to not actually get on them until you're pushed away from them.
Yeah, I think that's just a bit of the collision detection is perhaps not great, which is what's causing that. But, there you go. That one particular platform that you were trying to hook onto has the problem where it tends to keep going past it and then not connecting, which is a little annoying. Your grappling hook's not connecting. The grappling hook doesn't seem perfect to me. I don't think this is fun, but I don't think this is as polished as our previous Konami entry.
Yeah, I would agree, but, I still think this is a really good game that I would very much recommend to anyone who has a FDS. Like, I would play the hell out of this. And also, I think it's interesting playing these Konami games because I think we tried, like, three of them or something at this point, and they all use sound effects that I've heard before in other Konami games from the NES era, specifically Castlevania and Goonies 2. Lots of them.
Because, like, that's, like, one of that is the sound effect that when you throw your holy water in Castlevania.
And yeah, when you get hit by an enemy, it's the sound effect of getting hit in Goonies 2.
And the sound effect of you hitting an enemy is, what was that? I know that sound effect. But it's... Oh, and that's the sound effect of when you pick up items in Castlevania.
Yep. Yeah, it's Konami definitely has a sound to them. And
true.
That also applies to the music. Like, the music in this game is really good. So,
when we were discussing the Platforms and Pitfalls podcast, you mentioned, this is neat. So now we're on a raft, and it's kind of a, I wouldn't call it a shooter, but you move it around kind of like a shooter, and you've got to shoot at this dragon in the water. This is cool. It looks tough.
It is.
Oh, yes, I do like the death sound. It's very cartoony for some reason.
So, what I was going to mention was that there were two Konami games, or two games that used the same composer as Castlevania, and there was another game that used that same composer, and I forgot which one it was, but, so, I guess we don't worry about that, because I forgot what it was I was going to say about the composer for Castlevania. But anyway, a lot of these, this, you know what this reminds me of? It reminds me of every other game that inspired La Mulana, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I have absolutely no doubt that Narumura Takumi probably played this game at some point.
I actually really like this grappling hook quite a lot. So I am a big fan of a Super Nintendo game called Imihara Kawase, which is, I think, kind of a gold standard for grappling hooks.
Yeah.
And while I think this is not at that level, it definitely feels like it could have inspired a bit of that. Like, the way that it moves as you do when you're in the air feels just that little bit similar that I find very compelling.
You say it's the gold standard for grappling hook games. I think at this point it's probably the only standard for grappling hook games. There's not very many grappling hook games left out there.
Bionic Commando is obviously...
I mean now.
Oh, yeah.
Because Umihara Kawase is still being made.
Yes.
Yeah, that's true.
And
we even got a terrible fighting game in the series this year.
Oh, the only one I played was the recent Switch one, the Fresh, I think it was?
Yeah, so using the engine in Fresh, there is now a party fighting game called Imihara Kawase Bazooka, and it is... It exists!
Yeah, are you sure you even want to claim it as that?
I played it.
Okay.
I must finish all the Imihara Kawase games, and so I also finished Bazooka.
How was the Switch one? I have it, and I haven't spent any time with it yet.
Much like Sayonara, it's not as good as the originals.
Mm.
I think that's a topic for a different time, though.
Sure.
But there's a lot the Fresh is trying to do that's interesting. It doesn't quite accomplish it, though, sadly.
I see. Okay, so, anything else to say about this fun grappling hook Indiana Jones ripoff by Konami?
I think if you only play one of the games we talk about, it should either be Ice and Chinicole or this.
Fair enough. I think Konami's Famicom Disk System games tend to not get mentioned all that much, which is kind of sad because it tends to either be their cartridge stuff or their MSX stuff that gets talked about. But
or their Famicom Disk System stuff that came out in the US as cartridge.
Yeah, like Castlevania. So let's move on. So next we're going to play another Konami game. This one is called Esper Dream. And this is a game that I've heard talked about occasionally, because it is in sort of an RPG. It's an RPG, but it's an action RPG. Kind of along the lines of like the combat in something like Ultima, maybe, or what you call it?
For me, it actually reminds me of sort of Vermillion, but I'm not really sure. Like, my memories of that game are really slim.
Mm.
But I think it's kind of along those lines.
And it's in those lines in that you have discrete combat, out-of-combat sections.
Yes.
That's what...
Yeah, it's basically as you walk along, you see, like, little footsteps approaching you. They look like kind of like cartoon invisible person footsteps. And if you touch one, you go into a separate battle screen and you can... It looks like you can either kill all the enemies in order to leave... Or Or you can possibly shoot the wall in order to create an exit for yourself to escape. Oh. It looked that way because I accidentally hit the wall at one point and it started to break.
I see.
So I think that's how you can escape from battle if you need to.
But so I guess what I'm getting at is that like something like Ultima or the Falcom game, like Xanadu, you have a closed square sort of ring combat area that when you get into a combat, instead of it being like a traditional like menu based battle system, this is more of an action battle system in a closed off ring. And you're some kids who opened up a book, and now you're in the Esper world, and you gotta go talk to the mayor. You gotta make sure you talk to the mayor. Everyone in the town wants to make sure that you talk to the mayor.
Yeah, literally every NPC, until you've talked to the mayor, just says, go talk to the mayor.
I think even some of the doors say, like, go talk to the mayor. Mm-hmm. Like, I think the only person who doesn't say go talk to the mayor is the mayor. But yeah. Okay, so now we're in the combat, and you can break the walls to escape.
Does escaping the walls escape the combat?
I believe it would. I haven't tried it. Let's try it next battle.
Battle.
But yeah, it's interesting because this dungeon that I'm in is, it looks like sort of a max-sized house.
It's like it looks more like you're miniaturized, I would say. Can you break it?
I have to figure out which one it is. It's
that there's only one wall that's breakable. I see. So you have to find the wall that you can break to escape.
It does remove the footsteps when you escape from battle, even, though. So that's a way to get out of battles.
And interestingly enough, you've turned into a little minotaur-looking dude. I'm not really sure why, but you are.
Yeah, I don't really know the story of this game.
Well, the only story that I could tell is you open up a book and you get sucked up into the world of Esper Dream, which I guess you... I don't know. I imagine it kind of like Princess Bride, where it's a story going on while you're reading. Although that's more like that one Switch game, or that one indie game recently, the Zelda-style one. You know what I'm talking about?
Blossom Tales,
yeah.
Ah.
Where it's kind of like that, where the game is being narrated to you while you're experiencing it. Kind of like Princess Bride. This is not exactly that way, but yeah. So, not going to say a whole lot about this game, especially because there's a lot of loading times in this game.
Yeah, and
it's one that requires a lot of flipping the discs and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I will say, as far as the Konami games we've played go, this is my least favorite of the three, but this is still a game I would absolutely play. Like, if I owned a disc system back in the day, I'd have been all over this.
Ironically, it's probably the most well-known of the three. Partly because it's been translated, and partly because it's a little bit unusual for Konami. This does not feel like most Konami games feel like.
That's true.
So I think that's probably why it's a little bit more well-known, but it's even then, it's only very vaguely well-known. It's not super well-known. So, let's move on to our next game. Okay, so the next game that we're going to be playing is called Idle Hotline Miho Nakayama Tokimeki High School. I think that's the correct full title of it. And this is a game that I've seen every now and then on shelves and been like, what is this? Because when you look at the cover art, it's just like some very typical 80s looking, you know, idol kind of girl, pop singer kind of thing, holding a telephone. And I'm like, what's this all about, right?
I've seen it, yeah.
Okay, so press start there.
I have none of that context. I played this for the first time with none of this, having seen the box around or anything.
So she was apparently a famous idol at the time, you know, singer and TV and all that kind of stuff that they do. And this is one of the very first dating games that's ever made. It's definitely not the first dating game as far as I know, but it's very, very much the earliest inspiration for a lot of what we commonly refer to now as the dating sim genre. You're a guy who goes to high school, and one of the people that happens to be there is this idol. And your idea is that you're gonna, you know, meet girls, and you're gonna do stuff to make your character more popular and all that kind of junk. I haven't played it very much. But, in Japanese. So it tells you to flip the disc, which is kind of rare here.
Yeah, it's also, instead of, like, wait or loading, it says, Chotto matte ne.
You do get that every now and then, but not quite as casual as ne.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, he's got a big head.
He does.
I guess this is your classmate here, right? So you're in high school, and you're a typical otaku-looking kind of guy is talking to you. I guess he's your friend. And it's very standard, you know, like, talk, look, you know, that kind of thing.
And it's presented like a lot of Famicom adventure games were. Like, this would be after Famicom Tante Club and the Yuji Horii one that I forget the name of.
Portopia?
That's right.
Yeah.
Like, it's that similar sort of UI that if you've seen this era of adventure game, you know it already.
But it's the first time someone's turned it into a dating sim, I think. It maybe not the first, but it's the first kind of popularized one.
It's an early example.
Yeah. Some people have actually... I've read some places online that do say that this is technically the first dating sim game. I'm not sure if I agree with that, but that's what I've read. So... some of the interesting facts about this game, we're not going to talk too much about it, but... so, of course, this idol is a real person, and she was kind of famous, and so... okay, here, something has come up. So he just gives you a memo that says 03-540-0000, okay, on the screen. Big numbers came up. Tells you to write it down. Okay, so what this game's gimmick was is that there was a service where you could call that phone number in Japan, and it would give you hints about what to do next in the game. Or you might get a pre-recorded message from Miho Nakayama herself. And so as you progress the game, the phone numbers will pop up, and if you call that, you can find out what to do next or find out hints, which is a neat concept, even if it is kind of expensive.
That is super neat. Like, that is the kind of thing I think is really interesting. And there are a number of games that have used similar systems, but this is a very early example of that.
Dong! You have just, in typical anime fashion, accidentally ran into a girl walking down the hall. So, yeah. Very, very typical anime.
Of course, her reaction is, kya!
Yeah, of course. It's very stereotypical. But it does do some neat stuff. One of the things that's cool about this game, too, is that it used a device which I've never heard of, and I've never seen one. At least I don't think I've seen one. But it's a fax modem that connects to the Famicom, and you could actually fax in data. So a few games, and I don't know which games, but a few games apparently had the ability to fax in high scores, and the Nintendo would post them. For this game, you could actually fax in that you've completed the game, and you would get a promotional item back. And I think it was usually like one of those little phone cards they had in Japan, was really popular. They'd have like a character or something on one side, and then it numbers on the back that you could use to make phone calls. And those were really popular all the way up until like the early 2000s in Japan. You find them with lots of stuff.
To explain what they are quickly, so you use them with payphones, generally. Right. Like you slot them in, and they count towards that. So... pre-mobile phone stuff.
Oh, they're only for payphones? I thought you could use them on your home phone, too, no?
I think that you can call a number to route it through the fees on that card, but I think their main intention is using them with payphones around the city.
I see. So, that was one of the prizes, and there was a better prize that you could get if you were one of the, like, the first 100 people to get, like, the best ending in this game. But just the idea of, like, faxing your completion data to the company and getting a prize back is really cool. Some of the other neat things about this game, both Hironobu Sakaguchi and Nobuo Uematsu worked on this game. This is Uematsu's music. Well, I think... is this a traditional song or is this an actual...
It sounds very familiar. So I'm pretty sure it's a rendition of a traditional song.
So... Dragon Quest's origins lie in part with Yuji Horii and the Portopia series,
right.
And Square Enix's Final Fantasy iconic duo start with this dating game. And that's a neat, that's a really neat mirroring that should not have happened between two series that already mirror each other.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually, and I never thought about that. But it makes sense if you know a little bit about the history of how Square was involved, because Square was actually very heavily involved in the Famicom disk system. They created their own sort of semi-company thing, a group. It's actually called DOG, D-O-G, and it was Disk Operators Group or Disk... I don't remember. There's like several different potential... ideas of what it stood for, but nevertheless, it was called... I think it might have been Disc Original Group, is what I've heard.
Disc Oglers Group.
Yeah. But anyway, it was like four companies that couldn't get their games published and Square. And what Square did was they said, okay, we've got enough money to get your games published, so you create the games and we'll publish them under this dog title. And so some groups, companies like Hummingbird Soft and some other people released titles under Dog, and they were Square. And there's a lot of these games, and it's the common joke that you'll find online is that they're dogs. They're bad games, almost all of them. Deep Dungeon is a dog game. At least the very first one or two of them are dog games, and some other stuff. But so Square's staff was kind of heavy in being one of like the major powers in Famicom Disk System games, I guess you could say, like one of the top publishers for Nintendo. So it's not surprising that they would lend staff to this game. But yeah, so it's kind of a neat thing because of that. And then there was one other thing I was going to say. Oh yes, if you paying attention to the title of this game, I said it was Idle Hotline Miho Nakayama Tokimeki High School. And apparently, a lot of game designers knew this game. And this game is kind of considered the inspiration for a lot of other games. If you've ever played Konami's Tokimeki Memorial series, which is like considered like the standard for all dating sims from that point on, the designer of that game was directly inspired by this game and even used the title in his game. So, this game, while not necessarily good at all, or interesting really even, it might be kind of English interesting if you translated it to English, it's really important for almost completely and totally irrelevant reasons.
Also, I think it stands out as being an early example of a horror game on Famicom based on these chattering schoolgirls with their like chipmunk mouths staring back at me right now. This is quite horrifying.
Well, but they're in threes, which is the classic anime trope, which is you always have to have three followers with you, especially if you've got a group of, you know, the cool girls, and there's like one girl who's important and the other three that follow her around. Very Utena in that way.
Very Utena in that way.
Yeah. So, okay, we're gonna move on. So, the next game that we're gonna talk about very briefly is Ultraman. What was the full title of this? I forgot.
I don't remember.
Okay. Well, it's Ultraman, and it's like the very first Ultraman game on the Famicom Disk System. And this is a real Disk System game, so Gom, go ahead and insert that disc.
Alright, here we go. ASMR time! Oh, why is it stuck?
Oh, push the eject button.
Okay, there we go.
Okay.
It's easy to use.
My drive has been doing a thing recently where the eject button, if you don't press it all the way in, it kind of halfway goes. So you can stick the disc in, but not all the way. But yeah, this is a real one. So, Rowan, you played this Ultraman game a little bit. What were your impressions?
Well, this is my first experience with Ultraman outside of random Japanese ads. So, Ultraman is a very long-running Japanese TV series that's sort of a bit like Power Rangers, I guess, where you're a character who fights things in a regular size and then will fight things in a large size, usually by powering yourself up. So, this game features the dynamic of being small and being big as like its key gameplay mechanic, I guess.
Yeah.
Where you start off being a one-hit, easy-to-kill character with a gun, and you progress to the level, you find a giant monster, like a kaiju, like Godzilla or something, and you turn into Ultraman to fight it. You have a limited time limit on how long you can be in big mode for.
Yeah.
And there's a risk-reward of how early do you transition.
That's an actual limitation from the series, at least in the earlier ones. I don't know if they changed it later on. But in the original series especially, Ultraman can only be Ultraman for 1 minute.
Oh, okay then.
And then he has to go back to the human form. So that's why they did that way in this game. Yeah. Which is not loading, by the way. It's not loading properly. I'm not exactly sure why, but...
And the time is a bit more generous than 1 minute in this,
Yeah, also, by the way, the title, I couldn't make it out on the actual case because the font is kind of blurry and it's also very small. But on the title screen, it basically translates as, Counterattack of the Beast Empire.
Oh, that makes sense.
It's like Yaju Teikoku no Gyakushu, I believe is how you'd say that.
So So we're going to try one more time to see if we can get this to load. I don't know. This is a real disk, so you never know with these things. It worked before, but maybe it's not working now. But, yeah, it's an interesting game. If you like... There's another Ultraman game on Super Nintendo that's really famous because it's kind of like a... sort of like a fighting game, but one person. And this is more action-y platforming, and I think it's better, even though it's not great.
Yeah, it's got a lot of uneven aspects to it. Some of the hit detection's a little bit unusual. Like, I'm not sure why things are missing or not. But there's something about the little dynamic between being small and big and power-ups you find and things like that that I felt oddly compelled to keep playing it, much more so than some of the other games we talked about today, which I would say are much better, but I just walked away from quickly, partially because of time.
It is fun, and I think if you could get it to load, it would be worth trying out. But right now, I'm not having any luck, so we're going to move on to the last game. Okay, so our last game is a game called Sylviana something.
I think it's just Sylviana.
No, it's Sylviana Ipai something.
Ipai something, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It has a full title.
I just remember it sounded a bit like Opai for a second, and we were like, what? Yeah. This is one of the three games that we played today that are translated by a guy named Mute. I don't know anything about this guy named Mute, but whoever you are, thank you for your hard work in translating Famicom Disk System games. But, yeah, so flip that over there. And, Tom, I think you have some stuff to say about this.
Yeah, this is actually a game I have a lot to say about, not because I've played this Famicom Disk System version of it, but because I have played the MSX2 version of this game to completion. And this is a game I would recommend. I wouldn't highly recommend it, but I would recommend it. However, I would recommend the MSX2 version. It's one of the rare occasions where, when you have a multi-platform game on Famicom and MSX, usually the Famicom game is a little bit more polished. In this case, the MSX2 version is much more polished. Definitely a much better version of the same game.
I believe that's also been fan-translated, but not very well.
No, that one actually was fan-translated quite well.
Oh, okay.
But the fan-translation ups the memory requirement to 128 kilobytes for some
reason. That's why I've never played it, because I don't have an MSX that can do that.
But yes, this game is... you could almost call it an East ripoff, but a bit more repetitive. There's not as much to it. All of the dungeons basically look the same. The overworld doesn't have much variety to it. Enemy designs are sparse, and there's no mechanic where the combat uses the bump system like East, where you just run into enemies, you don't press any buttons. But there's no mechanic where you can be at a slight angle or hit them from the side and not take damage. Basically, every time you come into contact with the enemy, you will take damage, and so will the enemy. And it's just a war of attrition to see who dies.
Yeah, and so that's actually something that I wanted to mention, because to explain the plot of this game, you're a little girl, and your mom is sick, I guess, and you gotta go find this medicine.
That's basically the whole plot, yeah.
Right. But you don your sword and shield, because all little girls have swords and shields, and you go out and fight these enemies. And I think what I find cute about that is that this game's concept, other than your mom being sick, this game's concept is exactly what inspires a later game that I really love called Faerûn-e, or Faerûn, I don't know how you pronounce it. Faerûn is how I'd say it. Which is originally on iOS, and then ported to 3DS, and then got a sequel on 3DS, and then also on Switch in a collection called Faerûn Collection, which has 1, 2, and 2 bonus things as well that are like side games. And they play almost the exact same as this. It's where you don't have to actually hit enemies at an angle, you just hit them straight on, and you've got to manage your health, because you can get to like towns and stuff where you can heal, but you have to make sure that you don't attack too many enemies before you do that, or you're going to take too much damage and die. So there's not like a lot of strategy to the combat directly, but there's a lot of strategy to like how you manage your character and how you manage spaces.
Yeah, the other thing is, much like East, you can actually stand still on the overworld, and eventually you will automatically recover your health. And later in the game, you get an item that allows you to do that in dungeons as well. And yes, Rowan here got poisoned, and when you get poisoned in this game, you basically move at like one quarter of your normal speed, so you just are crawling along, trying to slump back to a town and if you don't have an antidote item.
So yeah, most games with poison slowly injure your character. This game slowly injures the player, in that they find it difficult to continue playing.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think at this rate we're probably going to be... just the rest of the podcast is just going to be you trying to get on poison. Because yeah. Even though you're in the town, it's going to take you another 10 minutes to get to whichever NPC can heal you. It is that slow, guys. Yeah.
But we've mostly said fairly negative things about this game so far, but in its defense, despite its repetition, I mean, I guess I don't want to spoil it for people in case you guys do want to play it, but...
Spoiler alert.
Well, I'm not going to spoil it. I will refrain, but there is something in the middle of the game that reminds me of things that later games have done that I was not expecting, and it really changed things and made this a much more interesting game. And there's also a concept right before the final boss that is the most ludicrous solution to a puzzle I've ever seen, and I absolutely love it. And the reason why I say the MSX2 version is better, they play almost identically, but the MSX2 version has much, much better music. You might be able to hear how shrill this is.
I'd like to point out that Rowan has now spent the past 2 minutes talking to three, now four different NPCs, and has still not found the cure for poison. In fact, there's only four NPCs in this town.
I've talked to all of them. There is no cure for poison here.
Great. So, what else do we want to say about this game?
Well, again, I would recommend playing it. As I mentioned, the MSX2 version does have FM music that is considerably better than what you're hearing right now, which is a bit shrill. It's the same music, but just better composed, more channels, better instrumentation, not as shrill. Additionally, the MSX2 version has much better colors. Mm. The colors are kind of pastel-y and a bit washed out looking. On the FDS version. The MSX version, they're much more vibrant, there's much more of them, and the palettes seem to fit the environments better.
I kind of like the pastel-y look, like the intro scene and things has this very, like, pink, air quotes, girly sort of aesthetic, and I think the pastels kind of suit that nicely.
Yeah, I would say that I love pastels, and as much as I love girly stuff, but I love pastels. And so for me, a game that's taking that theme and doing something fun with it, even though this is right now not very fun because you're moving at a snail's grandfather's pace, this is still a cool game. And if I could figure out, I'll probably have to do some research online and figure out how you get unpoisoned. I would like to sit down and play this game some more. I think this podcast has reminded me that I need to actually play my Famicom Disk System games more. Which is a fun thing about Famicom Disk System. There's lots to discover, even though it might not all be great.
And that's what I've taken away from this, too. Like, in the other podcast we did, I mentioned how I had this sort of maybe incorrect interpretation of what this system is. And playing it, the games Michelle recommended, has really made me appreciate its place in history. And how there's a lot of things that have either been forgotten that maybe shouldn't have been, and things that have gone on to do a lot of inspiration for other developers and other games. And I think that if you haven't dealt with the system, it's something that's really worth investigating. You'll find probably some inspirations to games that maybe you have enjoyed, but didn't know where they came from as such.
Try eating bread. That didn't help.
Try the other items.
Let's try the other items. Poppy? Let's try Poppy.
A third eye, I think, is the obvious solution.
Oh, Poppy works! Haha! Poppy,
so
we
you're
are
an
now
opium addict?
Apparently.
That's intense.
Cool. So what we've learned is that little girls carry swords and take opium.
Do you have any thoughts on the Famicom Disk System, Tom?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting relic of the past. The fact that the only actual disc that we tried to play we couldn't get working. Doesn't exactly bode well to its build quality, I'd say. And I know that's a common problem with disk systems, is they're not necessarily able to read discs a lot of the times, or, you know, things will go wrong, or you'll need to replace the belt, or it seems like there's a lot that goes wrong with Famicom disc systems, and it's unfortunate because it's a fascinating part of the history of, everybody's favorite retro console, so...
And it's a real shame that, like, Nintendo's Virtual Console also tends to ignore a lot of the disc system-only games. Even in Japan, I believe, for the most part.
There were a number of them that were on the little Famicom Mini.
Oh, okay.
There was a few of them, and I don't know how they handled the flipping the disc thing, but I know the Zelda, and I think Castlevania was... No, Castlevania, I think they got the American version. No, that's, sorry, different thing. I don't remember which ones, but there are at least a couple Famicom Disk System games that were on that. So they do occasionally, but it's usually like Zelda, Mario, Lost Levels, and so on. It's interesting to note that there is a version of Mario 1 for Famicom Disk System. It was such a popular game that they decided, oh, you know what, let's just pop it on our Disk System as well. And it was kind of a common one to find. That was one thing that you can do. I think I just bought two leather armors.
I also bought two leather armors earlier, so perfect. You've now got four. So you're well defended from leather.
Cool. But yeah, if you are interested in this game, I would say don't play it. Play Faerun. Otherwise, yeah, give it a try. This looks fun. I'd probably play this.
No, again, I guess I could possibly give some spoilers if you're recommending against it, but I guess probably I shouldn't.
Well, okay, look. So, we're almost done with our podcast, and we're all adults here. If you don't want to hear any spoilers, you can turn it off now and just... Oh.
Yeah, you entered a cave.
Oh, okay. I thought the Famicom died.
No.
Sorry. Okay.
Okay. Spoilers. Oh, and now you got knocked back out of the cave.
Spoilers.
Okay, so spoilers. This game pulls a Castlevania Symphony of the Night. At one point in the game, there's a mirror in a cave, and you get this item that lets you basically walk through the mirror into a completely reversed version of the game world. And that's the entire world, including all towns, all dungeons. They're all there again in a reverse format with strengthened enemies, different items for sale in the towns. It's kind of a whole new area. And then at the very end of the game, the final castle is on a tiny island that's maybe 4 squares across the sea from you. And you can't swim in this game, so you have no way of getting to that island. So of course the solution is to learn a spell that causes you to freeze all of the world's oceans to ice so that you can walk over them and get to the final castle. Which seems, you know, I kind of think that makes you the villain, but at the same time, it's a really fun mechanic, and it opens the entire world to you very quickly.
No animals were harmed in the making of this ending.
Yes.
Yeah, and I mean, in the nowadays, like, that's a really extreme solution to global warming, but it's, like, an immediate solution.
It's true.
There's something to be commended for that. This is ahead of its time.
There's also another point in the game where you need to cross a small water gap. Water is, like, such a weird obstacle in this game, but there's another point where you need to cross a small water gap, and the solution is to hatch this dragon egg so that the dragon will pick you up and carry you across it and then drop you down again.
So I would like to end this by saying that what is going on right now as they're talking is I keep dying because I have died and I'm restarting with 1 HP and I'm 3 screens from the town, which means that I cannot hit a single enemy before I reach the town. And so far, I have almost succeeded 3 times in getting to the town, but I keep touching a single enemy and die.
Oh, I guess one more thing I should mention. If anybody wants to play this game, there is a glitch you can exploit as well. When you walk off the left side of the screen, it scrolls kind of like Zelda. It does a flip screen thing. And when you walk off the left side of the screen and emerge on the right side, as long as you do not move any further left, you will be invincible. But you also can't hurt any enemies. For some reason, the rightmost part of the screen is like a dead zone where no damage can be done to anyone.
Well, that would be useful here if I could actually get anywhere. Ooh, as one evidence, HP! Yes. And enemies on top of me, but I'm not... Oh. And I scrolled the screen directly into an enemy and died. And with that, we have finished talking about the Famicom Disk System, so I want to thank Rowan.
Thank you very much for having me, Michelle. It was a real pleasure. And if you enjoyed this, please listen to the other half of our discussion on platforms and pitfalls.
And I think I'll try to come up with a little sneak peek for you on that, too. And Tom!
Thank you very much for having me.
This is not a ghost house. We are not Mario Brothers. Okay, and I am Michelle, and as always, thank you very much, and I will see you soon. I do not know yet if the Ancient Aliens in Games episodes, which is a three-part episode, is going to come out before or after this, but the first part is ready. So it's either going to come out right before this or right after this. And so I hope you enjoy that. And I hope to see you, hear you something next time. Take care. Thank you.